Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up on our Week in Review, Massachusetts politicians running for president, who's in and who's out.
You know, there's no way around the fact that the process is cruel. I think we realized that that was going to draw in and affect people we loved who were not necessarily prepared for that.
Former Governor Deval Patrick is definitely out. Elizabeth Warren is still giving it a hard look. Also, a district court judge under fire for apparently letting a defendant slip out the back door to avoid arrest by immigration agents.
Judges are not supposed to be in the business of obstructing justice.
It's all part of our Week in Review. Also today, X Conversations, a podcast about ex-cons trying to restart their lives.
I mean, I've been charged with all kind of stuff now, but I wasn't convicted of a felony.
Amazing.
Why would you disqualify me at this point?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and it's Friday, so let's jump right into our Week in Review. This week, the number of Massachusetts politicians who won't be running for president increased by at least one.
We realize that, you know, there's no way around the fact that the process is cruel. I think we realized that that was going to draw in and affect people we loved who were not necessarily prepared for that.
That, of course, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who dipped his toe in the presidential waters and then said no thanks. Then there's former Senator and former Secretary of State and former presidential candidate John Kerry, who said yesterday he's probably not running, not really, not now anyway.
Occasionally it crosses your mind to sort of think about, you know, would you, won't you? I think we got a lot of good people around, personally, and We'll see sort of where it goes, but I'm not doing anything to actively pursue that.
That leaves Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's actively considering a run, even preparing for one. So with just 424 days until the Iowa caucuses, who's running and who's not? And joining me now is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti website. Hi, Renee. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Hello and happy Friday to both of you.
It's good to be with you.
So let's talk about Deval Patrick, his decision to stay out. He talked about this being a cruel process. What's your reaction? I'll start with you, Renee.
Well, I guess, to be honest, I guess I feel a sense of relief because I think our state is still traumatized from the experience of Michael Dukakis and then John Kerry running for president. And absolutely, our politics have gotten undeniably more cruel and brutal since even those days. And, you know, accelerated by social media and by, you know, the internet generally and by the sort of lack of referees to try to keep our politics into some sort of order. So I completely understand it. I don't think anybody will criticize him for this decision. And, you know, I kind of hope that he'll stay involved somehow. I mean, I've got some thoughts about how he might do that.
Oh, good. Well, let's talk about that in a minute. But Jim, let me come to you and get your quick reaction from what we learned this week from Deval Patrick.
Look, I think we are in a cruel cycle. We go through these cycles all the time. If you go back to Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams, they traded, you know, accusations of, you know, you were sleeping with Russian prostitutes when you were ambassador to, you killed your own militiaman, Andrew Jackson. How dare you do that? We've seen a lot of it. We'll talk about H.W. Bush perhaps later on. That was a pretty cruel campaign as well, and I think the Mondale Reagan one was as well. So I don't think this had much to do with cruelty, because I think that if Governor Patrick could have lined up David Axelrod and that crowd around him, which is possible, that is a team that perfected the Machiavellian art of inserting the stiletto into the sternum with a smile on your face. So I think he could have handled that. I think the decision's based on two things. One is that I think Governor Patrick looked at this and said there's going to be a sort of two dozen politician pylon that he's going to have to kind of wake his way through. And is he the person to do that? And I think the second thing is, I think he understood that he could not win in this climate. And what I mean by that is, Look, if we are in a foul mood at full employment in a way that we've never seen before, can you only imagine when the downturn comes? And it's going to come. And it may actually coincide with the next cycle. A patrician-style positive message like John Kerry's or Hillary Clinton's, the Bushes, it does not work in this environment. You actually have to be something of a loudmouth. And that's not what he plays well at.
I actually think that... precisely for that reason, it might have been a good year for him, or that 2020 might have been a good time for him, because our politics, you know, in the last several decades has gone back and forth on the pendulum, swinging from one extreme to the other. And in a way, I think just what you're talking about, his idealistic kind of low-key positive message is a real... clear corrective to Trumpism, and you know, maybe that's what people are hungry for.
I sort of like that idea. To that end, I want to play a piece of tape from him, because I want to talk a little bit about what he might have brought to the presidential race. I mean, he campaigned for a number of candidates leading up to the midterm elections, and so here he is last month speaking in Cleveland about America, about what ails it. And his sort of reverence for, what he calls the sort of shrine of civic engagement. And he can, as you know, he can speak so eloquently about this stuff. And here's a little bit of what he was saying just last month.
When bullets fly in houses of worship or in schools or in nightclubs or in grocery stores, and our leaders choose the slogans of the gun lobby over the lives of innocents, remember that we cannot be great without being good. When unarmed black and brown citizens are shot down by unaccountable police, when our justice system is not yet consistently just, remember that we cannot be great without being good.
And he went on, he talked about, when we put people who are trying to get into our country in cages and separate families at the border, we cannot be great if we cannot be good. I mean, it just seems like he's the guy who can use words so well. I would love to have heard some of those ideas in the midst of this this coming presidential campaign. Whether or not he would have succeeded, I don't know. But what are we losing by not having him a part of it, Jim?
I think it's the height of his rhetoric has always been his great power. I remember the first time that he came to speak at a Pioneer Institute event, our entire audience of 300 people stood up after he spoke and gave him a standing ovation. He was a new governor at the time. And these were people who were probably not immediately inclined to support him, I'd say, right? So, I mean, that's the kind of power that he has. And he's an amazing guy. I guess what I'd say is look at the midterms, the people who won. Look at the way in which... certain people who were angling to become president are behaving. Look it back at how Trump mowed down an entire generation of Republican leaders as if it were a firing squad. True. And what I'd say is, look at Cory Booker, another incredible speaker. Kamala Harris, also a very good speaker. And you look at the way in which they're actually positioning themselves. I think the big news story this week, as it relates to this, and you think this is crazy, is France. Mm-hmm. That you have a president in France who's aiming for something higher, something more global in reach, something that aspires, if you will, to the better angels, and look at the response that he's gotten. I think, you know, in history, throughout history, whether it's the French Revolution, the American Revolution, it's down to the 60s and sort of the what I would consider to be sort of the crazy academic rebellion of the time, we go hand in hand with the French. And I think that we're in for some tough times to come.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think that's such a, dark, bleak, maybe accurate, but bleak view of our politics and of our future here. I mean, I think that... yes, I remember when Deval Patrick was running against Carrie Healey on the Republican side, and she accused him of, just words. Remember that? She said, oh, everything you say is just words, just beautiful rhetoric. And he said, oh, yeah, just words. Ask not what you can do for your country is just words. And, we hold these truths to be self-evident, whatever, are just words. And, he really does appeal to a higher... calling, I would say, in politics, as did George W. H. W. Bush and John Kerry and a whole other generation of folks who felt that running for public office was a kind of service. I don't know. I think that you're probably right that there is a international movement afoot, which is very dark. But we're never going to break that by, continuing to run campaigns with politicians who just play into that. We need to somewhere along the line, cut that cord.
So, Renee, you mentioned earlier in the segment about ideas about what Deval Patrick should do next. So we asked him whether this was the end of his political career once and for all. Here's what he said.
Well, who can predict? There are lots of ways to help, and I intend to be as helpful as I can in this cycle without being a candidate. Listen, I'm having a ball with our impact investing business. It's been incredibly powerful, and you know, if I can't in this cycle make change in government, I can make change in capitalism.
So Deval Patrick, of course, working for Bain, he's talking about the impact fund, which makes money while doing good. That's the idea anyway. But Renee, what were you thinking where does he go from here?
I was just thinking about the campaigning he did on behalf of so many of the congressional candidates in not traditionally Democratic districts, where he helped galvanize voters and make a difference in those campaigns. And I also think, you know, if a Democrat were to win the White House next, there's a cabinet position that, you know, could be appropriate for him. But, you know, you just have to divorce your Deval Patrick would have to divorce his idealism from his ego. You know, you don't necessarily have to have the spotlight on you as a candidate for president in order to have your ideas, enter into the conversation. And I just hope that those ideas he has about, public service and why we can't be great if we're not good, will get into the discourse in other ways.
So John Kerry is out. That leaves Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been actively preparing for a run. She says she'll be deciding soon. Not everyone is on board with that, including the Boston Globe. It editorialized this week and urged her to reconsider a run for the White House, calling her a divisive figure with, quote, a ceiling on her popularity. Unquote, pointing out that Governor Baker, in fact, won more votes than she did in this last election. Jim, what's your reaction to what's next for Elizabeth Warren?
So if I could, I'll get right to that. But I just want to comment on something related to Governor Patrick.
Sure,
if I could.
And
I think what's missing from what will be missed in terms of his non-participation in this is his connection between the good and who we are is extremely important. I think extremely important for the left. And what I mean to say is, and this is where I don't mean to be dark, but I'm a realist. We are in for another 10, 20, 30 years of great dislocations in terms of the employment base. This will affect the way that people behave and think about their politics. Mm. If we are completely disconnected in how we think about how we are as a nation, and that's nationalism to some degree, if we divorce that from the good and our conceptions of the good, we're in deep trouble, not just the United States, but everybody. And that's something that Governor Patrick is fully capable of articulating. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Elizabeth Warren is capable of that sort of thing, but I do believe the left needs that, because in this time of dislocation, you can see it in Europe, all over Europe. People are running for past identities and maybe new identities, and I think the Americans will also be up against that. Is Elizabeth Warren able to articulate that to some degree? I really don't know. But I do think that's the great intellectual challenge for the left if they're going to win from Trump. And that is to say, we have a different vision of what this nation is. And it has all these values from the past. And it also has a future that's positive. But at the same time, it needs to be protective to some degree, or feel some kind of protection for the people, because people are going to be hurt for over the next few decades because of all the dislocations. Mm. Just being a realist.
Renee, we're coming up on a break, but let me just give you the last few seconds to sort of offer whatever you would. I asked about Elizabeth Warren, but how do you want to close it out?
Oh, well, I think what Jim is saying is really profound, actually, and very true. And it's just a question of whether we redirect our rage as people who are hurting toward, what I would consider to be the true causes of these economic dislocations, and not on each other, which I think is what the situation we're in now.
Wow. Well, some great profound thoughts, for which I thank you both. We're going to come back. Stay with us, listeners. We have to take a break. When we return, we're going to continue our week in review with Renee Loth and Jim Sturgis. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's get right back to our week in review. With me are Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. And let's talk about the case of Judge Shelley Joseph in Newton District Court this week. She was hearing the case of Jose Medea Perez, arrested by Newton police on drug charges. He faced a fugitive warrant for drunken driving in Pennsylvania and a detainer from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And in fact, an ICE agent was in the courtroom, and Medea Perez faced the possibility of immediate deportation. So the case was to be continued. It's not exactly clear what Judge Joseph instructed, but after the hearing, Jose Medea Perez was escorted downstairs in the courtroom, released from custody, and allowed to leave through the back door and thus avoid the ICE agent. Governor Charlie Baker says Judge Joseph should be removed from the bench pending an investigation into all this. Here's the governor.
Judges are not supposed to be in the business of obstructing justice. And as far as I can tell, based on the facts as they were presented, she clearly violated the court's own policies.
Now, we spoke to former federal judge Nancy Gertner, who provides legal analysis to us, and she said Baker's position violates this important principle around the separation of powers. Here's Nancy Gertner.
Our governor, let me say this clearly, has no right to criticize to direct or to suggest that a judge should be taken off a particular case. He just doesn't.
Jim Sturgis, what's your take on what's going on in this complicated and sort of interesting case?
This one has a strange feel to it because I think, you know, everyone who knows who's followed Governor Baker knows that he's an extremely cautious person. So this one is kind of throwing caution to the wind to some degree. I mean, the fact is that once appointed, the governor has no control over judges besides putting forward a budget proposal that has impact on operational matters like, you know, are you going to buy an IT system? You know, what's your staffing? That's kind of the end of it. This is a separation of powers issue. Doesn't mean he can't talk to court officials, but whatever he says really has no holding here. There's going to be a federal investigation, and there will be a complaint, I believe, filed with the Commission of Judicial Conduct. That's the proper process. We get to the facts, and we make decisions. I personally get a little bit worried when I see at every level of government where people jump in and say, you're guilty without a process. I think, you know, people should just hold back and not feel like they have to give an opinion immediately as they do on Facebook.
Yeah, interesting. Renee, what strikes you about this case?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, first of all, let's stipulate that if the judge did turn off a recording device in violation of court rules, that's a bad thing and it's a bad idea. But to convene a federal grand jury to investigate her is a tremendous amount of overreach, I think, on the part of the federal government here. There is a process, as Jim said, for disciplining judges. It's to call in the Judicial Conduct Commission. But this is, it seems to me, a federal encroachment. We're talking about the executive branch of, in terms of Charlie Baker encroaching on the judicial branch. This is a federal encroachment on state courts. And I just think that it's a symptom of the federal government's probable, disappointment or anger. I don't even know what you would call it. You know, federal law enforcement is annoyed, let's put it that way, with the Massachusetts courts because of a Supreme Judicial Court decision last year that court officers cannot detain, hold people on immigration warrants alone, making ICE's job more difficult. And so it feels a little bit like payback to me. And I think it's just a bad precedent all around.
I mean, part of what's going on here, too, is that, at least according to immigrants' rights advocates, is that ICE is increasingly showing up at courthouses to make arrests. And to what extent is that a concern, Jim?
Well, you know, I think it's a question of, and I'm not an expert in the area of this area of law, so I don't know the extent to which an action by a judge to allow someone to leave the court, if that's what in fact happened, violates federal law. I just don't know. But if the feds actually feel that is the case, I would expect they would do this sort of thing where they'd place people into the courts. Is that a situation we'd like to have? No, it's not. But I just don't feel like I know enough about the federal legal aspect of it to give an opinion.
This defendant was free to go. Let's remember this, right? The fugitive warrant that was out for him turned out to be the wrong guy in Pennsylvania, so that was dropped. The drug charges were continued. you can't hold somebody just on a warrant, an immigration warrant alone. That's what the SJC said. So he was free to go. And you know, the judge let him out the back door instead of out the front door where he would have been arrested by ICE.
Right.
He was later picked up, you know, a couple of days later by immigration officials. And an immigration judge let him go. Okay, so he's still free pending his case. So, I mean, let's not blow this up into, you know, something that it's not. And you know, I think that we are in danger of just, you know, sensationalizing this case.
So I want to leave time very quickly to just talk about the passing of President George H.W. Bush, the 41st president of the United States. Here's Bush's eldest son, George W. Bush, speaking at services at Washington National Cathedral. We might not have the tape ready, or we do. Here we go.
Your decency, sincerity, and kind soul will stay with us forever. So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man.
So lots of remembrances this week. I'd love to just, by closing today, just ask you both for your thoughts on the passing of the nation's 41st president. Renee.
Well, you know, I covered the Bush inaugural in 1989 for the Boston Globe, so I knew him a little bit. And, of course, you know, he had just finished dispatching Mike Dukakis, our own governor. But, you know, everything has to be seen in context of today. And in that context, in the context of today's brutal politics, Bush does look like the last of a breed. Mm-hmm. You know, a kind of genteel WASP New England, Yale-bred ethic he had there of national service. And I think you can't take that away from him. But I think the legacy is mixed. You have to also remember that he got us into the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, and that he gave us Clarence Thomas on the U.S. Supreme Court, which I don't think anybody would say was his finest appointment.
Hmm. Jim Sturgis, final thought from you.
He had one of the best, I mean, truly a remarkable resume. He was, I think, more Yankee patrician, to Renee's point, than Lone Star Yankee, as some people like to call him. He certainly was not an ideologue, and there's a lot that's good with that in terms of compromise. There's a lack of clarity, I think, he brought to policy that came with that as well. He was absolutely globally focused. And if you remember at the time, he had no true domestic agenda. And in fact, I have to admit, that is why I voted against him and voted for Bill Clinton in 1992. I just felt like there needed to be a change. I think his legacy is dependent on President Trump, whether his new world order remains. And there is the fact that his son did set us on a path of extreme war for many years.
Mm. Well, Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thanks so much for coming in and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And thanks as well to Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti blog. Renee, thanks so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Listeners, stay ahead, stay with us. Coming up, a podcast featuring conversations with ex-offenders who are out of prison and trying to restart their lives. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Teimoula Abdar-Rahman has lived a really interesting life. He grew up in Boston, learned firsthand about the challenges of life on the streets. He became lead singer in a major pop band. More recently, he was the Muslim chaplain at Harvard University and is now the imam for the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. Teimoula Abdar-Rahman is also host of a podcast, which he started in 2016, featuring conversations with ex-cons who are out of prison trying to restart their lives.
I'm Teimoula Abdar-Rahman. Come with me as I take you into the lives of those who paid their debt to society and now they're trying to figure it out. This is X Conversations.
And Teimoula Abdar-Rahman joins us now. He's the host and executive producer of the podcast X Conversations. Welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to have you in, Tay. I'm really happy to see you.
Thank you for having me again, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I want to say that this podcast is really something to listen to. Just the reality of the lives that are portrayed are really striking. What inspired you to make it?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll try to make the story short. But, you know, in 2006, I left the Department of Correction.
And I went on a journey, man. I was at Northeastern University, then Harvard University, while simultaneously I started working as an educator at Facing History and Ourselves. Revolutionized the way I see things. Facing History basically helps educators confront the idea of social emotional learning through genocide, through the Holocaust. So we looked at the Jewish Holocaust. We looked at post-Civil War Reconstruction. So here I am, a black man, imam, Muslim, learning and teaching about the Holocaust, right? Learning to appreciate Jewish civilization. And at the same time, I enrolled for a graduate degree in a Christian seminary.
Wow.
So it's like it got really complicated and really fascinating. And so I began to think, how can I, man, I'm starting to learn so much about these people and their stories. How can I transform this and bring this back to my demographic? And instantly, bang, I thought about the guys that were coming home.
So the guys that are coming home, I want to play an example I want to give listeners just a little bit of a sense of this podcast. So here's an excerpt from X Conversations, episode 3. You talk to David DePina. He's also known as Crunchy.
Yep.
In the street, right? He was shot in 2 separate incidents. Several of his friends were murdered. He ends up serving more than a decade for murder on gun charges. So here's Crunchy talking about a big moment in his life. He was about to graduate from high school, but he was running around with some tough characters, got busted for carrying drugs, and his high school principal called him in to give him some bad news.
He was like, listen, I have to expel you. So I'm like, you let this guy stay in school. He got caught with drugs. And I was like, yeah, whatever. I was like, why? Because he's white and I'm black. Mm.
So looking back, you're a teenager. You're kind of a knucklehead.
Right.
Is it his fault or is it your fault?
It's absolutely my fault. Okay. 100% it's my fault. Because it's my fault because I gave him that perception. Mm. That's all he can go by is what I showed him at the end of the day.
I'm trying to get David to see things through the lens of his high school principal. It's easy to demonize the white administrator who seems cold and racist. But it's not always so simple. And it's not always about race.
That's the voice of Taimoola Abdar-Rahman. He's a host and executive producer of the podcast X Conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tay, tell me a little bit about this story of David DePina. What's profound about this story? Why did you want to feature him?
Well, I think when you meet David, he is, surprisingly very gentle, sweet guy. You wouldn't imagine him to be in any kind of trouble, right? He looks like he's 18 years old. He's in his mid-30s, first and foremost. He grew up in a 2-parent household. They were both both of his parents were addicted to drugs. He got ran in with the wrong crowd. And basically, through these incidents in his neighborhood, he got in a shootout and someone was killed. Hmm. While he's in the county jail awaiting trial for murder, he gets a call that his mother has been murdered.
Hmm.
And evidently, it was revenge for the crime he committed. So he's in there dealing with facing a life sentence. Now he's reeling over the guilt of possibly, you know, being directly responsible for his mother or indirectly responsible for his mother's death. So his story is really about, you know, how do you deal with that over a period of 10 years or so? How do you come home and pick up the pieces, ask for forgiveness, and try to move on and raise, you know, his daughter?
Is that the process he's in the middle of? I mean, is he asking for forgiveness? Is that what he wanted to do? Is that part of the challenge he's facing?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a guy who's deeply remorseful about, you know, the lives lost on, you know, that he was responsible for, as well as, you know, of course, his mom. But he's trying to pay it forward through being in his daughter's life, like full time. You know, this guy's really a great dad. And I think that's part of the story is that, you know, these people are coming home whether we like it or not. And we should know that, you know, for the most part, they're mostly successful guys. What about their stories? We hear about the negative stories, but what about the guys who come home and they're good fathers and good husbands and good employees and good citizens?
Yeah, and I want to ask you a little bit about the challenges that these folks face, especially the people who have really made a decision to leave the old life behind and want to create a new life.
Right.
And it's not always so straightforward. It's not, you can't just sort of make a change in your heart and say, I'm going to make this change, because you've got this sort of burden of that previous life. Right?
Exactly. I mean, first and foremost, the podcast is not about making these guys into victims.
Right.
That's important, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you commit a crime, you have to pay your debt to society. But the podcast says, okay, what if a guy has owned up to his crime, paid his debt, and now he's home? Doesn't he get a second chance?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And what happens when he's becomes a prisoner after prison through, you know, the Corey records and all of his, you know, all of the boxes and stigmatizing that comes with being an ex-con. So for him and guys like him, there's so many challenges. Once you get a job and they find out your background, you know, then they begin to exploit you for long hours and, you know, different shifts you don't want to take and, you know, talk to you any kind of way. So there's so there's so many levels of demoralizing in the process of their reformation or repentance.
So there's a good example of this, another conversation you have with a guy named Orlando Cruz. So right. When he was a kid in Boston, he shot three of his friends during a dispute. He served six months in a youth facility for that.
Right.
But then got out and went to law school and he became a lawyer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, but at a certain point, the law school confronts him and accuses him of not filling out his application honestly because he didn't reveal that he'd been arrested. So let's listen to a bit of that.
Cool.
I would not have lied about that. On my application, it wasn't on it. It asked if I had been convicted of a felony. I've been charged with all kind of stuff now, but I wasn't convicted of a felony.
Amazing.
My personal statement told you who I was, mm-hmm. where I came from, who I am today. I wasn't living a certain lifestyle. I mean, why would you disqualify me at this point?
So it's a great question. And things worked out pretty well for him.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
But that story he tells, and you made reference to the Corey records and stuff. I mean, this is a really hard set of baggage, essentially, indeed, to shed if you're trying to turn your life around.
Indeed. I mean, it's almost, they're up against insurmountable odds, right? And if you do anything as a youth, that's going to carry, you know, even though they say it doesn't, it carries with you wherever you go. And if you're not able to, Orlando was even almost on the brink of, you know, having his chances swept from under him, mm-hmm. you know, in that confrontation. But if you're not a guy like Orlando who's thoughtful, intelligent, and charismatic and has all of those great charms and gifts, then what happens when you make a mistake and you're a simple guy and you just want to come home and live a clean life? Oftentimes you don't get a chance to because of what comes with being an ex-criminal.
So what's the fix there?
The fix there, honestly, I believe is, you know, you got to look at criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
You got to look at some of the policies that are out right now, you know, and trying to really reform. When guys come home, give them a chance. I mean, when they're in prison, they're able to do great things and attend college. But if they're able to come home and utilize those credentials, then that's what's great. But if they're not, then it's just a piece of paper.
Right. So Governor Baker signed a major criminal justice reform bill earlier this year. Yep. Among other things, it raises the minimum age for juvenile offenders. It encourages the use of more diversion programs, restricts the use of solitary confinement in state prisons, eliminates mandatory minimums for certain low-level drug offenses. Is that a start? Is that going in the right direction?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that those things are pertinent. If you want to talk about real issues that people face on the day-to-day, that's where it starts.
Yeah. And what would be sort of on the top of your list of the sort of the next thing that needs to happen?
I think the next thing that needs to happen is looking at sentencing, because what happens is, you know, a guy could commit a crime when he's 19, 20 years old, and he has to sit for his natural life.
Yeah.
And so what happens when the brain is not even formed? I'm not the same guy I was 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
So now you're 45, you're a different person, and your life is over. You know, that's tough to accept. So again, it's really just looking at lowering that age so that you can say, look, people who are of a certain age, let's take into account that they shouldn't have natural life without the chance of parole.
Tay, one of the things, I think the thing that I love most about your podcast is you're a really good listener. You know, they say, what's the trick of interviewing people well and getting people to express themselves on the radio? And it's really simple. It's listening. Mm. And you listen really, really
thank you,
well.
Man.
No, it's
thank
really
you.
Clear.
Thank you,
but bro. It makes me ask, how do these stories relate to your life?
Right. I mean, honestly, I feel so much, I feel akin to these stories because I'm from the bottom. You know, socially and economically, I come from Roxbury. So, I mean, I have family and friends who are deeply involved in, you know, situations like this. And I grew up around these type of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be able to humanize them, right? I want to be able to deter young people with these stories, humanize them for adults, but also give hope to those who are incarcerated now that when you come home, you do have an opportunity to change.
All right. Well, Tamil Abdur-Rahman, he's the imam for the Massachusetts Department of Corrections, and he's the host and executive producer of the podcast XCon Conversations. You can find a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Tay, thank you so much for coming in.
My man. Thank you, Anthony.
It was a real pleasure.